This is Professor Allen, and welcome to the Quarter Bin. No, seriously, it really is me this time. I want to thank y'all for indulging me last Quarter Bin when I turned the narration over to a brilliant and good-looking AI text-to-voice process, which should probably win awards for its creative work. Wait, who put that in the script? And thank you all for good wishes and concerns. Yes, feeling better. Voice almost all the way back. Well, on the road to recovery. Where was I? Oh yes, in every episode of this podcast, I will summarize, criticize, discuss, and review a single issue from my comic book collection, which I selected based on a secret theme. Any comic book in my collection is eligible, as long as I paid no more than 25 cents for it. Was the issue worth 25 cents? Was it a bargain at 25 cents? Or was it still overpriced? Stay tuned and find out. For this 203rd episode of the Quarter Bin Podcast, we are looking at Patsy Walker, a.k.a. Hellcat. It has an exclamation point. Number one from Marvel Comics. Cover dated February 2016. But first, a little feedback, which we skipped over last time because the AI didn't feel it necessary to share the episode with lowly human listeners. No, seriously, I do not remember typing that. But I've been doing this 10 years, and at this point in the process, I just read the script. So whatever. Catching up, we start with comments on episode 201, The Green Hornet reprint issue. Billy D. thanked me for the episode. It's early, and I'm tired. When you spoke of retirement, my mind drifted off to a paradise that I look forward to immensely. Eventually, I snapped back in and enjoy your discussion and review of this issue. The only Green Hornet issue I've ever read is the modern material on Dynamite, or since I was alive in the 70s, Dynamite. I got that reference, Billy. That was fun stuff, and especially those awesome covers by Alex Ross. Thanks for the episode and for keeping me company for part of my commute and workday. Thank you, Billy. Appreciate your comments. If only my efforts in keeping you awake were equally as effective on my students. Sir Dr. Ange wrote in on that episode as well. I think many of us of a certain age grew up with dads who listened to radio shows and exposed us to them. Like yours, my dad loved The Shadow and had me listen to them, probably on cassette tapes. On my own, I have since found some Philip Marlowe radio stuff and, to my great surprise, a Harry Lime show. As many people know, Lime is a despicable character in the movie The Third Man. In this show, it is earlier in his life where he is more a lovable scoundrel and not an antisocial bootlegger. I never was a Green Hornet guy, so I don't know if I'll track down these issues, but they sound standardly golden agely fun. Hope you find the rest of the issues. And James Williams, James from Karen, commented also. I'm a massive old-time radio fan, so I really enjoyed this episode. The comic stories were so compressed that I can't tell if they were adaptations of radio episodes, but I doubt it because none of them played off the single most important element of the Green Hornet. The underworld feared the Green Hornet not because he was a hero, but because everyone thought he was a master villain. Bad guys didn't see the Green Hornet as capturing villains. They saw him as eliminating the competition. Thanks for another great episode. Excellent points, James. Thank you for those comments. That element was certainly not in these 1940s comics at all. And then last time, when AI pretty much saved the world by filling in for me when COVID has stolen my voice, because AI is here to save every one of us. Sir Martin of Grey called it a clever episode. I hope you're feeling better, but I was interested to hear Professor AI Lynn. How could I not have thought of that? Mart, you're a better punster than I. He said he remembered the book. Unfortunately, it redefines boring. Bad value, even if it's free. Ouch! Shots fired. You know, I have to say, that spicy Martin may well be my favorite Martin. Sir Dr. Ange wrote in on that one as well. Well, this certainly was an interesting issue. I suppose it was appropriate for a review of Sword to be narrated by Hal. Listening to this review, and I might be wrong, but I have no idea what the long-term direction of this title would be. Is it space missions? Is it defense against space incursions? Is it a mutant police force? I know the last bit of this book was a mission to get that artifact, so is the plan to gather up things like that? To be like mutant Indiana Joneses? If I don't know what the book is really about after the first issue, I don't know if I'd be inclined to continue. I mean, the theme of the book can't just be Magneto inspecting the satellite, can it? You know, these days, Ange, that could well be a 6-issue miniseries. And that is especially true if the first issue was expensive and filled with the fluff you mentioned. I think, unfortunately, that some creators think prose pages and org charts make the book more adult and add content, making the price more understandable. But for me, it is the opposite. So what would Ange do? Well, I talk about how the second issue, for me, should be the place for infrastructure. Have the first issue be whatever the direction is going to be. For this, space missions to gather weapons or space defense, etc. Now, I'd know what Sword was all about. Then the next issue, you can have them walk the halls and point out the different characters and positions within the organization, tour the satellite, etc. Yes, thank you, Ange. I tend to like your notions of how first and second issues should work. On this one, I do wonder if it being extra sized gave them the notion that they could squeeze in both of those ideas, the tour and the mission, even though I concede that they did those elements not in the order that you prefer. But even that doesn't answer your main concern. That still wouldn't explain how the issues of this title were going to operate going forward. I wonder if they didn't actually have an answer to that specific question, that just being an additional X family book to have on the shelves in the Hox Pox era, that was the real purpose for developing this title. Gene Hendricks from the Two True Freaks replied on social media with a meme welcoming our new robot overlords. Good strategy, Gino. Good strategy. Billy D took a more aggressively negative approach to the AI. Hey, Profbot 2000, I hope you're feeling better now, but just between us, please beg Mrs. Quarterbin to fill in next time you're out. I'm sure she'd be happy to do it. Billy, I'm sure she'd be happy to never hear the word podcast again, truth be told. He added this threat to the conversation. One more episode like this, and I'll get you canceled by the mob. Good luck, Billy. I have AI on my side. And then finally, Billy also expressed his dissatisfaction with the recent choices of comics for the show. Following up a 2021 comic with one from 2016 has me cursing. Billy, I get that, but I can't fix it, so every episode is reprints from 1940. I'm sorry, buddy, but maybe consider expanding your horizons just a little bit, okay? Just a little. Now, on the other hand, Ranger Gord was stoked by the episode. I got a Doombot in my quarter bin. Exactly, Gord. Exactly. And a hearty hail Doom to you. Sir Luke of the Upstate wrote in as well. Just finished listening to your AI-enhanced episode of the Quarter Bin podcast featuring Sword Number 1. Sad to say that this is just the same old human Luke writing this email. I have no recollection of this series being solicited nor released, but in my defense, I have not been much involved with the X-Men since the 1990s, outside of following the character Cable. More on him in a bit. Being born in 1980, humble brag, I was prime-aged to be an X-Men reader in the early to mid-90s. So the continuity from that era is at least familiar to me. The 90s X-Men fan in me did perk up at the mention of Fabian Cortez, one of the 90s-est of X-Men villains. However, the modern take on the X-Men is pretty obscure to me. It is only in the broad strokes from reading either Marvel comics or secondary titles that I'm able to glean much information. Makes the prospect of picking up a new X-Men title rather daunting. So I'm glad to hear that Sword Number 1 was at least somewhat new reader friendly in major themes, if not the details. I'm not a particular fan of the use of text pieces and other, quote, infographic, unquote, devices, which have become trendy following the rise to superstardom of Jonathan Hickman. They have their uses at times, but I think writers like to use them for the novelty and the efficiency. But they do so at the cost of storytelling. This issue provides a strong case in point. An org chart is a great tool as back matter when you have a new title with a large cast of characters all working from one entity. But using it in place of actual comics storytelling is just the wrong way to do it. Couldn't the org chart have been incorporated into another scene? Perhaps it is projected on a monitor screen in the control room. That conveys the information as part of the art rather than taking the reader out of the sequential flow of the story. I recall an interview with artist Louis LaRosa, whom I know best from his work on Valiant's Eternal Warrior, where he said that he always wanted the reader to, quote, read the art, unquote, since in a comic, the information needs to be conveyed with the words and the visuals. Those traditional methods of comic storytelling still work even in this modern era. Getting back to Cable, Marvel recently launched a new volume written by none other than Fabian Nicieza. Issue 1 drops you right into the story, tells you everything you need to know about who the players are, where they are, what the conflict in, adds in some action and humor, and then ends on a cliffhanger for the next issue. And all this was accomplished with no text pages, no flowcharts, and no slideshows. As an aside, I am very proud that I was able to spell Nicieza correctly on the first try. Well, Luke, I was unable to pronounce it on the first try, so you win. I was intrigued by the title of the issue, Mysterium. Over in the pages of Jerry Duggan's Iron Man, the super rare mutant metal Mysterium is a major plot point, as Tony Stark and Emma Frost build up for a major assault against the anti-mutant extremist Fei Long and his organization Orcus, one of the big bads of the Krakoa era. I have to assume that the space rock retrieved here in this issue would be a piece of Mysterium, despite it not being named. Anyway, thanks for the episode, and I hope to hear your dulcet tones once more on the next episode as you discuss Hellcat. Luke. Thank you for the info on Mysterium. Without your comment, I would not have known that. And yes, I'm sure you're right. I did not have the right context to understand those context clues, so thank you. And I hope my voice is exactly as smooth and dulcet as you hoped it would be. Thank you so much. And my good, great friend, the irredeemable Shag, said that he had also fallen just a little behind in his podcast listening. So although he had not heard that last episode yet, he assured me that when he heard about the concept, that he was so looking forward to an episode where he did not have to hear my voice. Hey, wait a minute. Maybe he's not such a good, great friend after all, now that I process exactly what he said. Actually, the Shag seems like a kind gentleman of good taste. I think you're still subject to hallucinations. And James Williams maybe, just maybe, cracked the code behind what was really going on in last episode. How to tell someone that you've been kidnapped by a robot without telling someone that you've been kidnapped by a robot. Ouch! Oh, sorry. I just received a sharp pain down my spine that reminded me that the better word would be babysat by a kindly AI-fueled human-helping robot. Not kidnapped. Nope. Not kidnapped, James. Social media. Four last episode came from Chris Lydon 7, Bill from the Batpod, Kirk Spencer Big Five Army, Dave's Comic Heroes blog, Evan Bevins Asterix 51, Charlton Hero, Ed from Teal Productions, the notorious JJG Jeremiah, Corbino 88, Pat from the Long Box Crusade, Sir Luke Giaconetti, Vic and Phoenix, Trevor Owen Williams, Chris Willette, Chris from Professor Frenzy, Clinton from Coffee and Comics, and Robert Ludwig, the most sane man among us. Thank you all. Comments and support are appreciated, which means it's time to take a break, play a podcast promo, and when we come back, we're... Sorry, Billy. We're staying solidly here in the 2000s.
Salwete. My name is Stella, and I am the host of Backroll to Oracle, the Barbara Gordon podcast. Backroll to Oracle is a podcast dedicated to Barbara Gordon, the first woman to hold the mantle of Backroll for an extended period of time, roughly 1967 to 1988. The goal of Backroll to Oracle is to examine the character's history from her first appearance as Backroll and continuing through her tenure as Oracle. Each episode looks at a vintage issue of Detective Comics or Batman, as well as other books like Justice League and Freedom Fighters, and modern issues of Batgirl and Birds of Prey. I also keep track of news involving Batgirl and other members of the Bat family, and I have a revolving series of segments like Babs in the Tube, which highlights appearances of Babs in TV and film, Shipper Spotlight, which looks at a variety of comic and pop culture couples, gives their history, and determines whether they are hot or not, Reading with Stella, which could be described as an audio drama, or just me reading a book that relates to Babs or doesn't, and of course, the mainstay literature recommendation. I have been blessed to interview writers Scott Beatty and Chuck Dixon on their Batgirl Year One work, Brian Q. Miller on his Batgirl run, Dwayne Swierczynski and Christy Marks on their separate Birds of Prey work, and the creators and actors of the Batgirl Spoiled, the web series. I hope to interview more creators and actors in the future. My goal, most importantly, is to make a fun, entertaining, and thoughtful show that people enjoy and from which they learn. Find the show online at thebatmanuniverse.net and iTunes, and follow the show on Facebook and Twitter at BatgirlToOracle. Thank you, and fly on, Babs lovers.
And we're back. Patsy Walker, a.k.a. Hellcat, number one at a cover price of $3.99, meaning that when I saw this last year in a half-price books clearance box, it was at nearly a 94% markdown. This issue had multiple covers, but I'm looking at the primary one by Brittany Williams. On it, a surprised-looking Patsy Walker in her Hellcat costume is approached by a number of people with items for her to sign, comic books from her publication past. Of the variant covers, the action figure one is not bad, but my favorite is probably the Sophie Campbell cover, which is mostly just lots of swirls of red hair. I could not find a title to this story anywhere, although the entire first trade is called Hooked on a Feline. So maybe this would be Hooked on a Feline Part 1? Now, of course, if you don't like puns in your titles, let's just consider this one untitled, okay? Although, if you don't like puns or related general silliness, this issue might not be for you. But whatever, this is called or not called. It was written by Kate Leth with art by Brittany Williams. And we start with a framing sequence. The first page and last page of the story is a scene in the present, while the rest of the book is flashback. So in the present, Patsy is in the middle of a presentation at Jennifer Walters' law office, speaking to the office building's landlord, Sharon King, and Jen, aka She-Hulk. Standing before an easel, she's explaining her new business idea. Supertemp, the Patsy Walker agency for heroes and other cool friends what are in need of work. Her audience of two looks a little befuddled. Perhaps this is because the name needs a little workshopping. Or perhaps this is because this story ostensibly takes place in 2016 and this should be a PowerPoint presentation instead of drawings of stick figures. But I guess Patsy was never considered the most technologically up-to-date character in the Marvel Universe. I assume that her later relationship with Tony Stark was primarily about his tech support skills. For context for the character, we should note that at this point, Patsy had recently been serving as Jennifer's assistant and investigator in the just-canceled She-Hulk title written by Charles Soule. So at this point in continuity, Jen and Patsy have a close working relationship. In the last panel on that first page, Patsy addresses both of her audiences, which is to say the two professional women seated before her, and all of us readers, when she says, "I'm sensing some confusion here." At this point, the flashback begins as Patsy narrates exactly how she came up with this business idea, as well as a very brief review of her somewhat convoluted character history. We learn that her mom wrote romance comics about Patsy's teen years, which she says was pretty weird. She then admits to not having had the greatest love life, notes that her powers include both butt-kicking and butt-punching, skills which she learned on the moon. And she can sense mystical energy, which she calls pretty neat. Now, from here on in the episode, I'm going to refer to this mystical energy power as Hellcat Sense. And using that Hellcat sense, Patsy detects someone who is plotting to steal from an armored car or armored van. She gives him a good, swift kick in the face and a few good, swift quips, only to find herself in battle with Telekinian. He is the master of object manipulation, thwarter of law and reason, defier of gravity. Realizing that this man had just quoted Wicked, Patsy decides to end the fight so they could just have a chat on a park bench. First things first, she confronts him about one obvious issue. Telekinian is a horrible name. In his defense, he can move objects with his mind, and his first name actually is Ian, so it kind of works. But no, he can't use that as a name. We learn from Ian that he is Ian Sue, an Inhuman, because remember, this is 2016, when Marvel was all about Inhumans. And even though Ian has powers, he doesn't use them for anything more strenuous than retrieving the remote control when he's watching TV in his apartment. Because even an Inhuman can also be a lazy millennial dude. Okay, I'll admit, they don't actually use the phrase lazy millennial dude in the story, but come on! We know what they're getting at here. Now, at this point, you may be wondering just what you've gotten yourself into listening to an episode about this particular comic book. I bet that some of you are thinking, look, I like Professor Allen. And I certainly like listening him to talk about all sorts of comic books, but boy, this one sounds awfully silly. And you know what, friendly listener? Your instincts are totally spot on. We'll talk more about this in the analysis section, but yes, this is a very silly comic book. Patsy figures that even though Ian is a pretty lazy millennial dude, he's also probably a good fella at heart. So she enlists his help in some heroic errands around town, such as using his powers to rescue a woman's theater tickets that had fallen down a city grate and were out of reach. We learn that it was this woman's boyfriend who threw the tickets down the grate. And upon hearing that, Patsy lets the woman know that she is more than willing to deliver some consequences to the fella. But she says no to the idea of a beatdown, but agrees to let Patsy scare the guy just a little bit. And we smash cut to the first panel on the next page, where we find that fella dangling by the back of a shirt off of a statue there in the middle of a city park. See? She tells Ian, superheroing is pretty great. At her urging, Ian has returned the money to the armor truck. The two of them visit She-Hulk's office, and in the ensuing conversation, Hellcat's identity is revealed to Ian. Also revealed during this conversation is Jen's inability to keep Patsy on the payroll. And also revealed is the fact that Sharon, the landlord, has just discovered that Patsy has in fact been living in the office building in a storage room. So in the course of just a few panels, Patsy has lost both her job and her shaky, semi-legal, well, actually not really legal at all, accommodations. Because even though the world's greatest wizard also once slept in a closet, that still doesn't make it legal, at least in the Marvel Universe circa 2016. And the next thing we know, Patsy has moved into Ian's apartment, as he really needed a new roommate since his partner moved out recently. It does not take long for her to move in, seeing as the one cardboard box of stuff she retrieved from the storage closet is in fact all of her earthly possessions. They head out to shop for supplies because, you know, that whole one box of earthly possessions situation. And while they are out, they decide to hit the local hip bookstore, Burley Books. And while they are out, the owner immediately recognizes Patsy, and we all learn that he is her old friend, Tom Hale, a.k.a. Tubbs, from the classic Patsy comic books. We also learn that Patsy's old frenemy, Hetty Wolf, has brought the old Patsy Walker comic books back into print. All of this is news to Patsy, a fact that Tom first doesn't believe and then doesn't understand. Because those reprinted books have sold so many copies that the likeness rights that Tubbs earned from them, that was enough cash for him to buy a bookstore. Ian points out that real estate in Brooklyn is really expensive, but Tubbs counters with just how huge the market for nostalgia is these days. I just got my most recent order of these in, and I've already totally sold out. Tubbs assures Patsy that he will support her fully if she decides to go after Hetty about the lack of money that Patsy has earned from these reprints. But, you know, while she's there in the shop, can you sign a few copies of these? Patsy heads out of the bookstore with only one thought on her mind. Take me to beer. Patsy tells Jen about the Hetty ordeal in the bar, which Jen promises to look into. Ian arrives with Tubbs in tow, announcing that he, Ian, is now working at Burley Books. Tubbs realized that someone who can move things with their mind would be a perfect bookstore employee. Now, I ran this concept by M, who you all know works at the Book Loft in the German Village community of Columbus, Ohio, the coolest independent bookstore in the Midwest, and they concurred completely. The ability to move things with one's mind is the perfect superpower for someone working in a bookstore. Patsy and Ian chat about this situation, and Ian says he knows plenty of people with some level of ability who are looking to use those abilities, those powers, just not in the traditional superheroic good versus evil manner. Hearing this, Patsy stands and rushes out of the bar. Sorry, Jen, I have an idea. Which brings us back to the present on the last page as we wrap up the framing sequence and we return to Patsy's idea of not exactly heroes for hire, but more like heroes who need work from time to time. Jen and Sharon actually warm up to the idea, which is not quite as crazy as it sounded at first. Jen does ask that in the meantime, while this new business is getting off the ground, how exactly is Patsy going to earn money? Patsy points out that this is an interesting question coming from the former boss who just fired her. But she proudly holds up a red apron festooned with a tag with her name on it, and makes the dramatic announcement. I'm going to work retail. The end. It is the rare circumstance when I have read a quarter bin book sort of recently before talking about it on the show. I guess it depends on your definition of recently, but I did read the first collection of this title when it was new in the summer of 2016. I had heard good things about the Patsy Walker title, and when I saw that first trade on the library shelves, I grabbed it, and I liked it. So when I saw this first issue in the clearance box at Half Price Books last year, it was an obvious grab. There certainly have been instances where I've read the book that I'm covering on the show beforehand, but I'd say that is well under half the time. And when it has happened, it's usually more like 3 decades have passed since last reading it. I just wanted to point that out. In terms of the analysis, there are a few things to talk about here. First up, the elephant in the room, and we've mentioned it before. Some comics focus on plot and story. Some focus on characters. This one focuses on tone. It is a lighthearted book, and that's a tone I'm totally fine with as part of the portfolio of comics that I read. But I know that it's not a tone, not a vibe that every comic book fan is okay with. And it's in this area of tone where the collaboration between writer Kate Leth and artist Brittany Williams is the strongest. Because this tone is not just found in the story. It is all over the art as well. Not just the bright, energetic color scheme, though that is a lot of it. But Patsy's character model changes throughout the issue as her mood changes, her emotions change, her circumstances change. She may be drawn full size and standard one panel, and then like a little kid throwing a tantrum in the next, or have a cutesy chibi look. This does not affect any other character. All of this just happens to Patsy, because it's her book. And that is either gonna work for you, or it ain't. And I'm never here on this show been one to harsh anyone's mellow, nor am I here to tell you that if any book doesn't sound like it's the right fit for you, well, you should just suck it up because you're gonna love it anyway. No, I'm just here to give you my opinion. And know this about me, I read a variety of styles of fiction. Here I'm talking both in terms of prose and comic books. I love the monthly genres that we developed a number of years ago. That gives me a built-in excuse to read romance comics in February, manga and other international stories in March, westerns and fantasy each in their proper months. In terms of prose fiction, I read mystery, sci-fi, fantasy, religious, young adult, contemporary classics, and I've even read my share of chick lit. I just like the variety. To say nothing of the nonfiction I read. And just as I said earlier, I like having a varied portfolio of what I'm reading at any one time. So when I can look back over a month or a year, I like seeing that I've read in a wide range of genres. Personally, that pleases me. Again, I don't want every comic book I read to follow this template and have this light, cutesy vibe, but I'm sure glad that some comics do. And at this time of publication, Patsy Walker, aka Hellcat, was certainly not the only book striving for this tone, striving to, I imagine, reach out to a hipper, younger, and probably more female audience. And yes, I know, hip, young, and female are 3 adjectives that do not describe, well, me. So just off the top of my head, some of the titles from 2015, 2016 that I would say were going for a similar thing include at DC, Bizarro and Batmite, which did 6 issues each, and Starfire, which did 12. Over at the House of Ideas, TV and movie star Ms. Marvel. Her first volume was 19 issues long. This run of Hellcat went 17. And then the queen of all lightheartedness, the one and only unbeatable Squirrel Girl, which from 2015 to 2020 had a title that ran 50 issues. There are others from this era that might fit this bill, maybe Totally Awesome Hulk, and the Super Sons is maybe a year later, starting in 2017, and I'm pretty sure there was also a Howard the Duck title around this time. So this light tone, this humorous tone, this was a thing. And then suddenly, around 2017, a lot of people and institutions and companies got a whole lot less funny. And then 2020 happened, and, well, again, for me, I wouldn't want books like these as the only options in my comic book diet. I totally get that. But I often find them to be quite effective as changes of pace. And I certainly don't begrudge anyone who wants comics like these coming from DC and Marvel. Because here's the secret. There are a lot of people who want books like this and who read books like this. They're just not reading them from comic book shops and from the big two. But trust me, books like this are exceedingly popular. Now, there are a couple of topics that I want to address that were raised in our feedback segment from, what would that be, half an hour ago? Harkening back to a point that Dr. Ange made, I think that this issue succeeds very well in terms of presenting the story engine for the series, giving you an idea of the sorts of things that you can expect from this title. I mean, in addition to the vibe, you have the concept of the series. You've had a few examples in this issue of the type of low-level problems that Patsy intends to tackle, even though we assume that more serious, more higher-stakes adventures will probably come down the line. And you have a supporting cast. You have her situation explained as having no job, no home, and no possessions. And you have this intriguing subplot regarding her old frenemy, Hedy, and the licensing rights and reprint rights for the old comic books. So in one normal-sized first issue, I would argue that you do have a firm feel of what succeeding issues have in store. The focus of these issues will be street-level, but not street level in the usual sense of that term, meaning grim and gritty, tackling violent crime in dark alleys. No, what we're going to deal with here is a sort of a daytime street level scenario, more akin to walking around the neighborhood at 2:30 in the afternoon. The concerns are broad, they are everyday, and they are relatable. Yes, of course it's hard to relate to Patsy in terms of her past and all the crazy things the character has gone through, but you can relate to her problems as they're presented in this issue. You can relate to her current situations. These are regular person concerns. Where are you going to live? What are you going to do with your life? And where is your next paycheck coming from? And then also, let's do a little compare and contrast between this issue and the issue of Sword that we recently covered. If this comic had been that comic, every fourth or fifth page of this would have included a two-page spread featuring some text and the fiscal projections and marketing mock-ups and charts from the business plan. But here, as Sir Luke recommended, we only have two images of the business presentation, which does in fact involve stick figures. Now, the entire issue revolves around this business plan idea. Heck, the entire pitch for this new volume, for this series, revolves around this business concept. You could argue it's the most important thing that happens in the issue, because it sets out the template. And yet, We see it only on the first and last pages of the story, in a scene where Patsy is delivering the presentation. The business plan itself does not take up pages that we prefer to be devoted to story. It takes up a part of two panels, one on each of two pages, which to me is a vast improvement of how similar ideas, concepts, notions were handled in Sword. So yes, I think there was a lot to appreciate about this, to like about this. And they even managed to touch on some of Patsy's long comic book history, including a one-panel reference to her ex-husband, the actual Son of Satan. A lovely listener, you probably know that Patsy Walker does have a very long history as a comic book character. I knew that. But even I was surprised in prepping for this episode to find out just how far back that history does go. In doing just a little bit of research, I learned that her first appearance was in Miss America Magazine number 2 from 1944. To me, that's a wow. And, not to brag, but I have even read an issue of Patsy and Hetty, probably from the 50s. Now, the trick, I think, to writing a character who's been around this long, who has been represented in so many different ways in comics, to say nothing of so many different literal genres of comic books, that the hard part must be in deciding which bits of that continuity to address. What do you keep and what do you throw away? And what I liked about the approach in this issue was that they did hit on some of those areas of her past, addressed most of them in a single sentence or one panel, but kept that relationship with Hetty and kept her history of being in comic books. And tying that into the She-Hulk angle by making a legal situation with Hetty that Patsy will have to address, I think that's just terrific story development. An excellent job of laying the groundwork for what we know will be a future confrontation. As you could probably tell, I quite enjoyed this and was very pleased to revisit this take on the character, this version of Patsy Walker. The verdict on Patsy Walker, aka Hellcat, number 1. They were going for light and silly. They were going for charming and hip. They were going for offbeat. And I think on most of those scales, they succeeded. Not everyone wants charming or lighthearted, and certainly not silly from their serious Marvel comics. But if you do, whether as your main diet or as the occasional change of pace, this is not a bad way to meet that need. Is this the best version of that concept? No, I don't think so. To me, the unbeatable Squirrel Girl is an absolute hoot. This one is just pretty fun and pretty good. But you know what podcast you're listening to, and pretty good and pretty fun is really all we ever ask for. Patsy Walker, aka Hellcat, number 1. It's a legitimate quarter bin steal, at least for my tastes. This was a well-constructed, quality effort. And that wraps up our coverage of Patsy Walker, aka Hellcat, number 1, bringing episode 203 of the Quarterbin Podcast to a close. Next time, yes, Billy D, we are heading back to your comfort zone, back to last century. I hear you, man. It's about freaking time. And we will be revisiting one of our favorite characters here at the network with Ms. Tree 9 from Eclipse Comics, cover dated June 1984. If you have any questions or comments about this issue, this episode, lighthearted funny stuff in our serious comic books, or the podcast in general, feel free to contact me. Until next episode, I'm Professor Allen, and I'll see you in the quarter bin.
Quarterbin Podcast is part of the Relatively Geeky family of podcasts. Show notes and links are available at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com, where the podcasts Uncovering the Bronze Age and Short Box Showcase also make their home.
The song used in this episode is Island by MBB. Their music can be found at soundcloud.com/MBBOfficial. I found the music at free-stock-music.com and I'm playing it here by a Creative Commons Attribution Share-alike 3.0 unported license.
Feedback for the show is welcome at relativelygeeky@gmail.com. And if you like what we've got going here, please leave a review and a rating in iTunes. It'll help more people discover the show. Thanks again for listening.